Welcome to Culture, Talent, and Growth. Join Anish Shah and the Ruckus team as they invite dynamic leaders to share what they've learned about creating lasting culture, attracting great talent, and achieving sustainable growth. Let's get started.
Welcome and thank you for joining us. This is Leveraging Podcast Marketing. Now onto some introductions from our speakers.
My name's Anish. My background is helping to run growth for different companies. I grew up in the Bay Area. I moved to New York about 4 years ago and started an executive recruiting firm. Now we're a team of 18 and we recruit senior level folks, primarily in growth, product marketing, analytics for fast growing companies.
I am Dan Granger. I'm CEO and founder of Oxford Road. Before starting the company, we started in 2013 and I spent 10 years in the radio business and really got to see firsthand the need that existed in the marketplace that podcasts were able to step in and fill. So we launched to kind of ride that wave and be a part of the revolution that was happening and turned out to be a great thing for advertisers. And today we are the leading self-funded audio agency in the marketplace and very proud of some of the work we're able to do.
Awesome. I'm Christina Rubino. I started and lead the offline marketing discipline at Right Side Up. We're a growth marketing consultancy based in the Bay Area. We work across pretty much every paid channel you can think of with hundreds of consultants and a large full-time team. I myself, Anish and I swapped places. About 5 years ago, I moved to the Bay Area because I was convinced that no one was seeing my display advertisements. That was, you know, a little prescient of me, but have since just really embraced offline marketing. I've worked in-house publisher, agency, consultant now, and just really enjoy helping brands find ways to scale beyond like the paid search and paid social that all of us have kind of relied on for a minute, but excited to chat with everybody.
Hi, everyone. My name is Molly Laufer. I've been in the consumer tech customer acquisition marketing space for about the last 10 years. I moved to the Bay Area 10 years ago. I started my career in marketing as the first employee at a direct-to-consumer e-commerce subscription snack company called NatureBox. I started actually buying podcast ads back in 2013 when the industry looked a little bit different than it did today. I've actually since then worked both agency side. I worked, funny story, with fellow panelist Dan Granger's team, as well as fellow panelist Christina as a colleague of mine. So it's a very small world, as you'll soon see. I've also worked in-house in a variety of offline marketing growth roles. Currently, I have my own freelance consulting business. I primarily work with e-commerce and consumer tech companies, helping them test and navigate and scale offline channels. And I'm really excited to be here today. Podcast advertising, as I was telling the folks earlier today, my fellow panelists, I was saying podcast advertising can often be like the gateway channel into other offline channels. So really excited that's the topic here and look forward to chatting with you all.
Hi, my name's Mike Kropka, one of the partners and CEO at Ad Results Media. Similar to Dan, one of the largest audio influencer advertising agencies out there. We're up to 100 plus employees. We've bought over $2 billion worth of audio specific ads over the last 23 years and really excited about the space. It keeps growing. There's a lot more people getting into it. We're seeing larger brands enter it. There's been a lot of questions on, is this just a direct to consumer channel? Is this for brands? Really excited to see both of those types of companies coming together and seeing success and happy to talk with all of you.
Awesome. Thanks for introducing all of yourselves. So the first one, it's a very, very, very broad question. Maybe you can go back early in like your existence of podcast marketing, but what was the greatest challenge you've encountered in podcast marketing? All the way from like expectations to execution to any amazing anecdote that might be ridiculous.
So I actually have a paid search and paid social background myself. And when coming to podcast advertising, I just remember feeling the latency of the performance in the channel and knowing that was going to be a challenge for any marketers I work with. And that is held true today. So because of the on-demand nature of it, the consumption curve of the media itself is delayed. Downloads delayed, consumption curve is delayed. And even still today, I mean, literally today, I'm navigating questions from brands that are like, you know, we've been live for 2 weeks. And it's like, yep. Most of the people that have heard your ad have not engaged with it yet, because what do you do when you listen to podcasts? You kind of like chunk them up and you might listen to a bunch of them in one sitting. And so we have to, as marketers, adapt to the medium and the way the medium is consumed in order to see the best performance of it. And just advising and preaching patience and practicing patience when we all know that as growth marketers, for a variety of reasons, we are not the most patient people on the planet. I think that is one of the biggest challenges that I continue to encounter. We've actually done a lot of like publishing on the topic itself and have done some stuff about like minding the ramp of new campaigns and observing the fact that they all kind of tend to ramp similarly, but it's every single time I can almost set my clock to it, depending on the advertiser. There's a moment where everybody's like, is this thing on? Is it going to actually work? Do we just waste a bunch of money? You're like, we didn't waste money. It's fine. Just hold tight until the second integration and then let's see what actually performs.
That's awesome. What is the timeline from client freak out to, oh yeah, shit, this might actually be working? What is that like timeline?
I mean, you're talking about a matter of weeks. So what we usually tend to see is that you'll accrue your first week or two of spend. Everybody will be like, guys, we spent like $40,000 and we've seen 6 conversions. And you're like, yes, well, first of all, there's indirect activity. Put a pin in that. I'm sure we'll talk about that a bunch later. The other part of it is, so when it comes to the download and consumption curve, you're seeing, I would say, like a good chunk, like maybe up to half of downloads occurring after the episode of the podcast is published. Just because the download happened doesn't mean people are listening to it then. That's actually a fuller like 7 to 21-day consumption curve. So, and that hasn't changed. I mean, you know, Dan, Michael, like you guys have been in the industry for quite some time and that consumption curve is still pretty much static. Like we've done additional testing on it. It just seems to be the way people consume and engage with this channel. So you tend to see when you space your integrations out, you'll tend to see performance kind of rebound and pop from 4 to 6 weeks into the campaign. We usually advise about a 7 to 10, 11, 12 week media live period so that you can observe the full consumption curve of media and then figure out where to go next.
Yeah, I think it takes time for people to see results too. It's something where you might hear it once. You might need to hear it 2 or 3 more times before you might take action. It also kind of depends on the brand and what the consideration time is. If you're buying a mattress, you're not going to listen to that ad and then go buy the mattress that same day. So I think repetition is key and it does take time. We've had clients that maybe stopped the campaign and didn't think podcasting was for them. And they later did some drag analysis and found out 6 months later, the channel was their best performing channel. And so it takes time to figure that out, but it's kind of this weird hybrid of an online channel and an offline channel. And people have trouble compartmentalizing it and they want that immediate gratification, just like anything else in life. And so there's that patience element that you really have to breach.
Totally.
It makes a lot of sense. And are they, during those 2 weeks of patience, are people just continuously kind of like, well, what about today? What about today? What about today? What about today? Or do they eventually come down when you're like, oh, this other brand took 2.5 weeks. This other brand took 3 weeks and this is what they got. And so therefore, if you want to be like them, you just sort of wait and that's what it took for them. So, you know, setting that benchmark, has that been pretty helpful for you?
I would say like it's expectation management, like anything else. You can expectation manage your way throughout the launch period and the free launch period. But once it goes live, that's the moment of freak out. And then it's just how you work with people as a human being. I mean, I find like occasionally consultants will still pull me in and be like, could you just like remind this person that like when you did it in-house, it was okay. Like everything's going to be okay. And that's part of why like people work with consultants and agencies. It's like, well, if you were doing this in-house and you had no frigging clue, but you've done a ton of paid social, you'd turn this off after a week and a half and you get a false negative in the channel. So it's like not being alone in these channels, if you don't have an in-house marketer with the experience in it, is really helpful because it helps you avoid the false negative or false positive that can come from like testing one show and seeing results, but it was a $300 show. And when you try to scale it up, it doesn't work the same and vice versa. You won't have the patience in-house if you don't know any better, especially not if you'd like sit 4 desks away from your CEO and they happen to be an ex-growth marketer and really want to talk about performance today.
I am glad Christina brought up the point about false positive or false negative, because I think that is the greatest challenge. And then, you know, that has like several different kind of applications in podcast advertising, but I think it boils down to how do you know what shows to buy and how many of those shows should you buy? And there's someone can probably quote me the exact stat on just how many podcast shows there are out there right now and how many of them are out there that are currently accepting advertisers. But the point is, like, we're talking about, you know, in the 6 figures. How do you know which podcast shows to buy? And we could probably talk a whole hour about that. But I think that is really one of the biggest challenges is you only have so many marketing dollars to invest. And if you buy the wrong thing, if you buy a thing and that one episode or that one show that you buy is wrong, you might, to Christina's point, say, this channel doesn't work and turn it off. I always tell people this, do as I say now, not as I did then. But 8 years ago, I bought one podcast episode from one guy and it was a smashing success in 2 weeks. And frankly, to be honest, if it hadn't have been, I wouldn't be on this panel today. Like I wouldn't be having this conversation. I got lucky, right? But more people have gotten unlucky by buying one show of one episode than I did. So I think that's really one of the greatest challenges is there's so many shows out there testing broadly across different genres, different audiences. And again, it depends on your product, right? Like if you have a product that, you know, only is targeting women who are 18 to 34 or only targeting, you know, men who have, you know, a specific type of truck and, you know, X credit score and are looking to refi their home, that's going to be a little bit harder. But generally speaking, if we're talking about a product with relatively broad consumer appeal, knowing, you know, being able to test across the landscape, testing different hosts, testing different genres, it's hard, right? There's a lot out there. And how do you wade through it? And how do you decide what to test, how often to test it, and at what frequency? I think that fundamentally is one of the biggest challenges in the space to this day, even. And again, don't do what I did.
Well, it was easier to get lucky back then because the barrel was a lot smaller and there weren't as many fish. Like you're talking like a couple hundred thousand podcasts now. It's like something like 2.5 million. But I think we looked at them and we said of all of them, we did something with Magellan last year. It was something like 30,000 of them really were like accepting ads or even viable for ad acceptance. And then on top of that, it's like, I would say right about 10,000. We regularly buy between 1,800 to 2,500 shows.
And that's still a lot, right? Like if you're a one man or one woman show, like yes. Way through the 1,800 shows, like that's still pretty substantive.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, that's a very good question. How do you? Is it imperative if you're going after such a massive amount of buys that you need a lot of analytics people to crunch the numbers for all of it? Or not so much? Or do you need just a ridiculous amount of coupon codes and unique URLs and, you know, whatnot? Like, how do you do it on such a massive scale?
Yes.
I think all of the above.
I don't know if we're ready to get all into attribution, but certainly there are a number of different ways you can come at it. There are no perfect ways. We have to kind of go with the best of the worst and manage expectations around that. I think, you know, expectation management really extends into all of this. But, you know, it doesn't have to be that complex if you can find one barometer that you can lean on and have some confidence in. Hopefully you can cross-reference that with something else. But I think one of the most important things is that you have a measuring stick and you're using the same type of stick for all the shows that you're active on. And, you know, it's one thing to measure the channel. It's another thing to get that relativity on a show-by-show basis, which is why, you know, in this day and age, we're still using things like promo codes and vanity URLs. It's really hard to get that relativity in an accurate way.
Yeah. So pixel-based attribution has come to the medium in the last couple of years. As a former paid search, someone who has started a bunch of trading desks over the years and has bought my fair share of programmatic media, I approach it with a healthy dose of skepticism. And I think that there's a time and a place to use all these different modalities. The one that we found the greatest consistent success with is the combination of promo codes and or vanity URLs and some sort of post-purchase or post-conversion survey. I did not want, and people on this panel can attest to the fact that I did not want that to be the method of attribution that we used. I was very used to, when I came into this channel 5.5 years ago, I was very, very used to pixel-based methodology. What's changed since is GDPR and privacy regulations and iOS 14.5 coming up iOS 15. And so that is pretty much a bit of a challenge for all of the pixel-based measurement modalities in the space. The other problem, as we're seeing with Facebook and data degradation, is that when you rely on this kind of basis for just one channel, trying to first look at how that channel performs, to Dan's point about using the same yardstick, you also want to use some sort of a form of attribution methodology that ties all of your channels together and lets you understand a full picture of multi-channel attribution. The challenge with pixel-based methodology is statistical significance. So it's, do all of the shows that I want to work with accept the methodology and the basis? And then also just like it's, you know, it can straight up be a scale thing. The real challenge is going to be in the next like 6 to 12 months, how stable that data remains. We haven't had the greatest luck trying to use it consistently for incrementality testing. We've had more success with post-conversion surveys when they're run in a way that allows you to accrue enough data that makes it a significant result. And in, you know, in a way that's not like causing any kind of like false result where it's like, oh, we have it alphabetized and advertising is the first choice and we're all lazy because we are, because Google's made us lazy. And we picked the first choice and oh my God, people selected advertising. What did you know? So it's only as good as the survey itself and the promo codes and vanity URLs and the structure of the offer and all of those things. There is pixel-based methodology can help in some instances where it's more of a brand advertising campaign where you're looking for like kind of a secondary attribution methodology. We don't generally advise that people use it as their first attribution methodology because there's also view-through performance is getting shakier and shakier, as we all know. And that is what kind of makes me nervous for brands to invest a lot of time and effort into setting it up. Because to me, first of all, we haven't crowned a winner in the space yet. And then the other part of it is just how does it actually compare to on-the-ground optimizations and direct activity?
How is it tracking with pixel-based? Is it, I'm on Stitcher, I'm on Spotify, and it's saying like me, Anish, is kind of like listening to this, and then it's tracking me as a part of like a CPM calculation? Or is it like a link is in the podcast I'm listening to and I click on it and then I go to...
It's the RSS feed.
Okay.
Yeah, so the RSS feed itself is pixeled, which is a whole other thing that like a lot of podcasters are varying degrees of comfortable with. But for the ones that have done so and have embedded it, either it's host enabled or they'll embed it in their RSS feed themselves.
Okay, so it's fully click through and you're getting a CPC on it. You're not just seeing that I am a listener of this and then putting me toward a CPM.
Well, so we are seeing that you were a listener of that, and then view through comes in by the fact that you were seen by that pixel, and then essentially the internalization of that data is when the view through activity occurs. And you can see like part of the challenge with that is that Facebook view through attribution used to be such a damn slam dunk because I don't know about you, but 4 years ago, everybody and their mother literally was on Facebook daily. So when you think about that kind of a cookie pool, your view through attribution is going to look very generous, which
very
is
very greedy. I'm
very greedy. Also, I remember back in the day with Facebook, they were like 30 day view through. And I literally remember telling my Facebook ref, like everyone on the internet is on a 30 day view through. What are you talking about? So it's just, yeah. Now, unfortunately, it's just my mother who's on Facebook. And that's why we're all looking at channels like podcast advertising, because it's one of the only channels that I find is still consistently, after all this time, like driving real customers and driving real activity that's attributable.
I will say, so I would say as a general rule of thumb, I absolutely agree with Christina using the vanity URL and promo code and how did you hear about us or post-purchase survey. I'd say about 99% of the time, that's also what I recommend. I actually have a specific client that I work with right now that only uses pixel-based attribution. And so I've sort of developed kind of a, I'd say a unique perspective on it that I really didn't expect to come to. But it is exactly what Christina said, that view-based conversion can be very generous, right? And it can very much over-attribute someone to a podcast channel where maybe they had already been on your website the day before. Mm-hmm. Maybe they had already been exposed to a Facebook ad 2 days before. So I think in that case, and like I said, there are some brands, and I'll use this client specifically, is in that category that's very competitive. It's very hard for them to get host read endorsed ads because there's very little white space. So they have to rely more on using dynamically inserted ads more front of network than host, which again is the separate sort of side of the industry. And it's not the areas that most of us kind of generally operate in, but because they have those limitations, they end up running more of the run of network. They also don't have unique promo codes, unique URLs. They don't have any other offers. So for a lot of brands, you might have like a percentage off or a discount that you offer in your paid channel. This is a brand that doesn't have any sort of, you know, offering any sort of promotional offer for one channel versus the other. It's the site offer and that's what you get. And so for that reason, pixel-based attribution makes a little bit more sense for them, with the caveat, like Christina said, because this this attribution window is kind of so wonky. We have to A, have a very narrow attribution window. And then B, what we actually do is we tie that impression level log back, right? So we see a client was
right.
They were exposed to an ad, but then right. We know that they placed an order. And then we go back on our side in the database and say, all right, well, when did that person first come to our website? And when was that person first exposed to an ad outside of podcast? And if the podcast ad was at the beginning, giving it a first touch credit versus an at the end. And I would say that, again, like I just spent 2 minutes talking about something that is sort of like the 1%. It's almost like the edge case. Because like Christina said, the channel, that methodology is so new, not all networks, you know, use pixel-based attribution. And that if you are going to use pixel-based attribution, I think there's a lot of caveats to it. And you have to really make sure you're doing everything you can to align it with your digital marketing efforts and with the way that your digital marketing exactly. is measuring it. Otherwise, like you said, it's like apples to oranges.
The point about dynamic insertion is really well made, because that is why, if you think about traditional digital delivery, you're delivering on an impression and you're tracking an impression. You're tracking view through activity based on an impression. So when you're buying on an impression basis, and when you're buying in a manner that basically everything is a little bit more trackable yes. in that. So like when you're doing an impression based buy, it's a good point. We also commonly at times have implemented it for B2B. Just because for the same reasons, it's like a promo code. Like, what are you going to do? Discount a $50,000 piece of software? Like, yeah, okay. Like that's it. It's to be able to do something meaningful at that scale. It's like you put 20% off on that, you're going to put a hurting on the company. So I think it's just another tool. Like all of these are tools in the toolbox. I also love that we're 20 minutes in and we're still in the first question. So endemic. We'll get there. But
we don't have to get there. We can just stick right
here. We don't really just say here. We'll hang out here.
Not bad at it.
We'll just hang out here in our cocoon. But it's the tools in the toolbox and knowing when to take the right tool out, right? If you use a hammer when you're trying to use a drill, you're going to have a bad time. So precision.
I'd say to simplify it too, there's not a lot of options. So kind of use what's available and what makes sense. And for us, we kind of try to triangulate. So if there's only two or three options and all of those work for that brand and that client.
Great.
Great, and kind of give all those a shot. And then it's nice to have that reference point in comparison, because not everything's as simple and straightforward. We have some larger brand clients, take a Molson Coors, for example, where list studies it can be something that's interesting to them as well. And that can kind of sit on top of it along with pixel-based attribution. Like Molly said, promo codes don't always make sense and work. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a pecking order that we typically go through, and embedded URLs are probably the least favor the bunch, because the likelihood of you remembering some long URL is a little bit more challenging, at least for us from what we've seen. But it's kind of what Christina said, we really love kind of that post-checkout survey. If done correctly, you can implement that wrong and get misleading results. But it sounds very simple and very archaic. But we've had a lot of clients that learn a lot more about their other marketing channels because we had them implement that post-checkout survey.
Oh, yeah.
And they thought other channels were really doing well and doing amazing. And then they actually saw kind of what, like, to me, that survey, the actual customer is telling you exactly what made them buy. So you're not relying on a pixel. You're not relying on anything else. Like, they're telling you why they bought. And if they clicked through a paid search ad because they forgot the name of the brand, and they're saying podcast was why I bought, Joe Rogan influenced me into determining I want to buy this product. That's very powerful, and that's indisputable within the organization that they're working with. So I think that to me is, like, if possible, very valuable, and it's added a ton of value outside of podcasting, which is kind of cool, because people thought certain channels performed well, and they look at their marketing mix and it's way different. And it's better than a lot of those fancier multi-touch attribution tools that I think muddy the water even further.
The amount of actual MTAs that I've engaged with and like logged into and seen implemented in my career, I can count on one hand. So everybody always talks about MTA and multi-touch attribution and doing the models, but then when they see the price tag for it and the actual correct implementation of it, they're like, well, I don't know. We want to figure out something else. And this is a good way. If you're spending less than 8 figures, survey-based methodology will hold really well for most offline channels. And even digital channels. I have some clients now who are actually taking it, and because of the attrition they've seen on the data and with Facebook, they're actually using survey-based methodology to triangulate some of the indirect activity that Facebook's view-through conversion used to take credit for.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, if people who are listening to the panel right now, even if you're not on offline channels or it's not maybe on your roadmap for another 3 to 6 months, I say go ahead and put the How Did You Hear About Us survey on right now. I work with a lot of clients in the very kind of like early stages of even thinking about offline. And now's a great time, you know, before you start to diversify, start to get like a get and figure out what that false kind of false negative is. Put podcasts on there when you're not on podcasts yet. Put a radio on there if you're not on radio yet and start to see, you know, where your customers are shaking out. And then the sooner you start that, it's like anything in attribution. Like the sooner you start it, the easier it is to look back on it versus trying to implement something, you know, in the 3 weeks before a campaign goes live and, you know, your product team can't fit into the sprint or you can't get it up in time or there's some nuances with the data or how much data you're collecting. So I'd say if you're listening to this panel and you're thinking this sounds interesting, go ahead and try to implement a post-purchase survey as soon as you can.
Yeah. And there's actually, I'll disclose, I'm an equity advisor for them, but I've been using it for a long time before. Enquire Labs is a good Shopify app for it. I've also seen people use Get Site Control if they don't have in-house devs who can like easily implement something. There's a bunch of other opportunities, but if you're in the Shopify app ecosystem and you're D2C, Enquire is a pretty solid bet. I think I think there's a couple of ways that you can do it in a homegrown way. I've seen fewer of them be successful. I would err on the side of using some sort of a plugin, some sort of an SDK or something, just because we all obviously have, you know, tight sprints for devs. So I think we all want to just reduce the amount of work we have to give them because there's 18 other things we want them to do for the marketing team. So
that's awesome advice.
Thank you. When partnering with a podcaster or attempting to partner with a podcaster, like what are you looking out for? I think you touched upon a little bit of it, like, you know, the audience that they have is relevant to the audience that would be normally buying your products. But I'm wondering whether it's a lot more nuanced than that. And I'm sure it is. So I'd love to know like the vetting process. And then beyond that, once you've sort of like vetted and said, oh, these are the ones who are right for me and our audience, at least for a test, what's next? Like, do I just pick up the phone and call somebody who can call someone and get us on there? Do you email like info@email? Like, what's the process from the beginning to end?
Well, I'll start with the first piece of the question, which is what do you look for when partnering with a podcaster? Because it's very counterintuitive. And I think we've all experienced that. You know, the myth is that if you just target the right audience with the right people, then you're going to get the best results. Now, the reality is, I imagine most people that are listening to this are going to be looking at ROI. This is not an awareness campaign. This is about driving sales and conversions. And that being the case, sometimes the thing that you think is perfect for your audience actually is going to perform horribly. The other piece is we all love the fact that in this business, you get the medium becomes the message and the person who is the centerpiece of the content will actually then turn and start advocating for your product. That's awesome, right? But a lot of people think that, well, if they do a really good read and that if they really get the personalization right, then it's going to work. And what I think we've all seen a number of times is you can have the perfect fit on paper for targeting. You can have all the passion in the world. They can do a 7-minute live read for your commercial and it still doesn't work. And then you go somewhere where they're totally apathetic. They're reading the script. You're mad at them because they're like not interested at all. And results are through the roof, right? So the number one thing, and I'd imagine the group would back me on this. I think the number one thing is track record for the show for similar advertisers. Now, there are differences. They do reach different types of audiences. But if you know that you've got three similar, if you're B2B and you've got a certain type of entrepreneur you're trying to reach, and you see that there's three people that are consistently advertising on this program and they're using codes or vanities, you know they're tracking performance, that's usually going to be a safe bet. And it's not always just because they're talking about business content, right? It sometimes defies your intuition.
Yeah.
And with that, with like a podcast that has a good track record with other brands that you feel good about, and you can see that those brands are doing the right kind of attribution-oriented steps to actually track, you're thinking that they're actually doing a good job of tracking and it's they're continuing because it's been positive for them. Is it hard to then get on those podcasts where those brands who've been on there and seen consistent performance are like, no, we're actually going to take all these slots. And the podcaster being like, wait, what do we need new advertisers for? We got these ones who are just sticking around. MailChimp is just going to buy with us for the next 5 years and take up all of our slots. Like, does that ever happen to where it almost makes that process of looking for someone with a track record, then you need to look elsewhere and be a little bit more creative and look for the person who's going to, you know, be the next one to have a track record?
I would say sometimes, yes, definitely.
Okay.
Sometimes, definitely.
Yeah, I would say I hear you on the track record. I think for me, being on the cusp of figuring out and buying the newer inventory that's released by networks and publishers, we've found a lot of success, kind of like taking a little bit of a risk, but a calculated risk. So if we know that the network and the publisher has a good track record, they tend to project downloads conservatively instead of with a wish and a song in one hand and the other. A lot of it is also like you have to kind of train yourself out of the things that you look for in other channels. But contextual advertising is such a slam dunk a lot of the time in digital. It can really perform inconsistently in podcast if it's not also layered on with like a host whose audience follows their every word and will actually buy things when she tells them to buy a new, you know, custom fragrance product or a custom shampoo product or whatever the case might be. So it's a little bit of like the performance track record history. I think this is also where brands can get a little scared. It's really like the things that Dan is saying to look for, you can actually look for in Magellan, which is, I think, all of us use for competitive intelligence, air checking, et cetera. It's like the leading platform in the space for it. You can use that for show discovery. You can also use that to get in touch with shows. We, as Right Side Up, as a practice, we're buying, I mean, on a monthly basis, millions of dollars in podcast media. So we generally have contacts and, you know, the agencies have contacts as well at all the networks, publishers, partners, et cetera, that you'd want to work with. We also try to work independently and independent publisher direct when we can. So that's another thing, just to be able to kind of like piece out and remove some of the middlemen, I think has also helped us from a partnership perspective. Just being able to have like, there's a brand that we work with and it's the kind of brand that like, it really is advantageous to have a founder on when we're working with larger podcasters or something like that. Treating it like partnerships, even though you're paying for it, will get you a very long way. So that's also something to look for. Like, are they, yes, you know, there's a media buying transaction that's occurring here, but is the partner engaged? Are you, you know, are they taking the time to like understand your brand? And that's the producer, the host, whoever, but whoever's working on it, do they actually understand your brand? Are they able to give a good, credible read on the topic? Even if they're just reading talking points, you still want it to not be the first time that person ever saw the copy, which happens more often than we'd want. So it's, you know, it's, I would say those are, that's a lot of it. Also, it's just media pricing, you know, candidly making sure that the networks are projecting downloads in a way that is within the realm of possibility. A lot of the times we'll test into shows that don't make a ton of sense on paper. You know, we work with one of the leading meal delivery platforms and they were like Suburban Women. I'm like, yeah, they need to order dinner. But you know who like doesn't want to put on pants and wants a cheeseburger? Gamers. I could say that because I am one. And that's where we found a lot of success and scale. So it really is like, it's the art and science part of planning very much in this channel, more so than other channels that I've been in since like 2011, when we were all buying digital media this way still.
I think to me, what's similar is it just with all the other marketing channels is kind of that test and learn mentality. Like if all of us knew 100% what would work for every single advertiser, like we'd be doing something else with our lives because we'd be reading the future. And so I think it really kind of comes down to testing. And if it's somebody new in the space, that's a lot harder. And that's why you work with somebody like one of us on this panel, because we already know where the buried treasure is. If you're established in this space, there's always that test and learn. You always need to be testing 20-30% of new shows and seeing what works. That's a lot harder these days than it used to be 4 or 5 years ago, similar to Facebook used to be very easy 10 years ago. Everything kind of changes and evolves. And I think trying to be on that leading edge, I'm always shocked. Everybody wants to buy kind of that new celebrity that has their own new podcast. And typically the loyal following of that celebrity is not as strong as that celebrity thing. And they find out very quickly. And that's kind of just a fascinating thing in the space to me is, well, they're on air and they're exposed. And are people going to respond the same way that they do to Joe Rogan, for example? And are people going to listen to exactly what they say and go do it because they're such a fan? They want to help them out. And that relationship and nuance is is fascinating. And that's kind of where Christina said, kind of the art and the science kind of come together. And you learn from testing. If we grade every single ad that somebody has and we give them feedback, so they might be horrible on that first read because they thought they were doing what the advertiser wanted and it maybe didn't come off as authentic, and you give them feedback, and we've seen it time and time again, all of a sudden they start performing really well with some feedback. So there's just a lot of nuance in it that kind of gets better over time.
Makes a lot of sense. So let's say you're sort of unsure a podcaster has the attention span to really like take everything that you're putting in front of them and be interested and read it the way you want them to read it and put the exhilaration into it. You know, are there some tips and tricks for getting them more engaged with what you're putting in front of them? You know, is it a function of on one side being very, very operationally organized and getting them like really great paperwork, lines, directions? Or is it the other side of like sweet talking them and grooming that personal relationship and trying to get on the phone with them and like getting them to have that emotional attachment to whatever you're doing?
There's no substitute for good onboarding. It's a both and. I mean, look, you have to have, if you want somebody to go out of their way to go to your stupid vanity URL and like write that down, like you need an offer, right? You need something that's at least as good as what they're going to get anywhere else. You want to be clear about what this product actually is. You're probably going to have some mandated points that you want to get across. And that happens behind the scenes in the kind of the writing and the scripting. However, then you send it over to them and they have to, you know, their job is to interpret the thing. Hopefully some of them won't. Some of them are just going to read it. But if you can get familiar with them and get them familiar with it, you know, like I think Christina may have mentioned, like getting the founder of the product on the phone with talent can be really, really impactful because nobody's going to sell it better than the founder.
Nope.
And the talent's going to absorb that enthusiasm and that passion. They're going to get fired up. They're going to be more invested because you're not just a name on a piece of paper that's sending them instructions. You're, I met, you know, Michael on the onboarding call. So I think that it's behind the scenes operationally, it's strategic writing, but when you can, as much as you can, go big on your onboarding.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that because when I was in house, I was working in a vacation rental startup and I remember being on an onboarding call with Ben Shapiro, and he's like a fast talker. So like, you just like, he's ready to go. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to mention this. And I'm going to mention that. And I'm like, okay, awesome. He was super excited. He goes, and I'm going to talk about the kitchen the whole time. And I was like, I don't have kitchens featured prominently in my copy. Ben, why are you talking about the kitchens the whole time? And he's like, well, I keep kosher. And so using a vacation rental for me is just my default status. I don't even use hotel rooms anymore. And I was just like, I need to change all of my copy. Like, I got so much out of the onboarding call. I got more out of him than he got out of me on that call. And the other thing I'll tell you is, don't be cheap about sending them product.
Yes.
I swear every single time somebody's like, they only have 2,000 listeners. Well, fun fact, they have paid social. They do stories. If it's something that they're wearing all the time, like we work with a couple of wearables, you'd be shocked. Like people are going to be like, if it's a ring, people are going to be doing other recordings and you'll be able to see it on them. Right. So it's just that these are the things that it's like, yes, for a small audience like that. No, if you have like a, you know, $1,000 mattress, your calculus is going to be a little different. And I absolutely understand that. But if you're selling snacks, you better be ready to send everybody a crap load of snacks. Like when we sent Joe Rogan, I think like the office size boxes of Nature Box stuff, because we were trying to screw with him because he loved these two snacks more than anything else on this earth.
It's the Racha roasted cashews. Yeah.
Yes. And the Big Island pineapple. These are also, me and Molly will never get the space in our brains back. It's just not even possible.
I think like that's one of the biggest things the podcast channel brings, right? Is someone is putting their voice behind your product, right? That testimonial is so, it's not necessarily what you're paying for per se, because, you know, a host is not going to talk about a product that they don't love. But that's, I mean, we're talking about CPMs between $18 and $45. I wish I could see the eyes of everyone, all the digital marketers' heads pop out. When you're talking about a $25-ish CPM, like, that's a lot of what you're paying for. So make it worth it.
Yeah. You're paying for a human connection with a listener, which like, I don't know about you guys, but when I used to tell people I worked in display advertising or paid search or whatever, I would get like an apathetic reaction. Like, oh, you're the one who serves me the banners. Like apathetic to negative, right? literally, if I tell people I work in podcast advertising,
oh my God, I love so-and-so and I love this. And it's just all they want to do is talk to you about their favorite podcaster. One, listen to them, because that's how I find like baby shows. There used to be this great office manager at one of our clients that I used to talk to all the time, because she would give me like all the really good like Bachelor shows, like all the good stuff. So it's like, you never know where that's going to come from, but it's a really strange channel. It's not an old channel. We forget that. But, you know, the entire channel's been around for 20 years, really, 22. You know, when you think about channels that have been around for 100 years and have been accepting advertising for 60, there is a reason that, you know, we're still kind of building this as we're going, because we're buying media the way that I used to in 2012 digitally. And so we're on that same trajectory, right? We're going to start seeing the application of technology. We've already started seeing the acquisition volume of shows and, you know, publishers and this whole Russian nesting doll effect, and Spotify's trying to buy the entire, you know, green earth and scorch it. It's just a really interesting time to be in the channel. And we're just going to continue to see it get more complex. It's not a reason not to advertise. It's a reason to advertise right now. Because we all know that the advertisers that had scaled Facebook and digital between 2012 and 2016, they're doing okay right now. So you have to kind of look at that and say, like, okay, podcast advertising, YouTube influencer, all these, you know, even some of these channels like radio, terrestrial radio, satellite radio, stuff that you're like, I think like Don Draper bought that. Well, guess what? It works really damn well after all these decades, and it's real advertising. And I wish that I had maybe a tenth of my old brand advertising budget. I would do so much with them right now. So much.
I love your point about everyone doing well from who was in, you know, paid social, paid search in 2012 to 2016. I'd only correct you with one little point. They were doing well back then, and now they're doing shit now with those exact same campaigns that they were running in 2016. So, and that's why they
need that's a good point
to all of you and switch their media budgets from, you know, basically two platforms, because those campaigns are not as easy as they were back in the day.
Another point too that I would make on the Facebook point, Anish, that you said, because like you said, a lot of brands are having trouble scaling Facebook, or they need to diversify. I would also make the case that podcast advertising can also elevate your Facebook campaigns, right? Because if you're a brand that's spending six figures a month, if not more, on Facebook, you hear people saying all the time, I keep seeing this advertised on Facebook. And if you're a direct-to-consumer e-commerce company, you're a disruptor of a category that is, you know, trying to go direct-to-consumer now versus buying in retail. People are always saying, oh, I keep seeing this product advertised on Facebook. Is this cookware any good? Are these snacks any good? Is this food any good? Is this mattress actually comfy? And what podcast advertising can do is it can layer on a lot of legitimacy to this product, right? When hosts are saying, I sleep on this mattress, I use this cookware pan, I wash my hair with this, I take these vitamins, my kids eat these snacks. That really can actually lift up your Facebook advertising campaigns, because now people are saying, oh yeah, I keep seeing this product on Facebook, but when someone I trust told me that it actually tastes good, feels good, works good, then I used it. And then guess what also happens? Now your Facebook retargeting campaigns can also become more effective because they've now heard the product somewhere else. So I would say it's like, yes, I want you to advertise more on podcasts too, but it's also like a rising tide will lift all boats when it comes across your acquisition portfolio.
Yeah, high consideration, right? It's no longer one view to get someone to purchase. And especially when something has a little bit of a higher price point or is a major purchase for your family, like a mattress or something like that, which, you know, can cost what, I don't know, $300 to $700. I want to go back to this earlier question though, of like, we got part of the way. So I think all of you touched upon, all right, what you're looking for initially in the podcast that you would like to advertise on. Okay. And then there's like basic operational steps then to get your podcast or get your ad on their podcast, which I don't know what those are. I'd love to know, like, all right, you've targeted the people you want to target in your media plan. Now what? What are the operational steps to get your ad on the air?
I'm happy to answer that if you guys want. So there's a few different ways to crack that nut. If you're working with an agency, they'll do the media placement and buying for you. If you're working in-house fully, the way that you're going to do that is to reach out to different networks and publishers in order to know what shows go with what network. You do need to work or use something like a Magellan. We also, as consultants, have those relationships. And the difference with our model versus an agency model and the way we work is that we buy in-house. So it's a little different in that we're not commission-based. We're buying directly with partners and owning the relationships in-house. So we're reaching out on behalf of advertisers to basically start that relationship. The problem or the challenge is that it's not platform-based buying like we're used to with Google and Facebook. They've kind of spoiled us and chunked all the inventory in one place. It is much more like RFP documents in email, buying with Excel-based insertion orders. We use Google Sheets like it's our job because it is. You know, it is more of a very, very manual process. You can use some of the trading desks to access some audio inventory. But to your point, Anish, the stuff that really works and sells out year in, year out, the stuff that all of us buy the most, you're not going to be able to access that through those platforms. You can't buy, you know, Spotify is doing a good job of like in-housing some of the big shows. But when it comes to like the small to mid to decent size performance inventory, you've got to buy that direct from somebody. And it's very much similar to like an insertion order process that you'd use whenever you buy like site direct media or publisher direct media. It's very, very similar. Highly manual, which is why we dedicate so much time for our consultants to the launch phase, the launch period. But that's part of the, you know, getting people to endorse for you as well. Like that there's a human being who's making a decision as to whether or not they accept your ad, which is an interesting dynamic too.
Makes a lot of sense. And where does price negotiation go in that whole thing? Is it pretty set on a weekly basis where the podcast hosts have a representative who, it, like they're larger, who is kind of setting that based on CPMs, popularity, whatever else? Mm-hmm. And, you know, can you sweet talk someone into getting a better price with anything kind of like interesting that you could offer them?
I'll give you a great example. So there's one brand that we work with and they do fertility testing and they have the cheapest price out of any. There's this one show we work with where everybody's around like $4,000 or $5,000 net on a show. This one brand has it for $2,500 an episode. And the reason why is because the host has a personal fertility story and a personal fertility struggle. And she was just like, I want that advertiser. I used it. I love them. I love what they're about. I want that advertiser. And so it offers you the opportunity to negotiate like one-offs like that. I will say, I think there used to be a big advantage for tonnage in the space. And there is still some advantage, right? Like if you go with an ad results or an Oxford, you're not going to overpay for media, right? The difference now is that it's very much market dominated and market demand set pricing. Right. So if all of us are in the market and we're trying to buy a finite amount of inventory, right? Because there's what, 52 weeks a year, say they publish 50 episodes, three ads an episode, it's 150 slots. Like it's just not a lot. So if you think about it, the advantage that like larger buyers had is kind of being eroded a little bit. Like they still know where to look and they'll still get really solid deals based on tonnage. The difference is that you're not overpaying in-house the way that you might have 6 or 7 years ago, when it was just rate cards were all over the place. There wasn't a lot of standardization and there wasn't a lot of market competition. Now it's very much more decentralized where you're seeing that rate cards are kind of coming down to earth a little bit, but you're also just seeing that people are paying for the inventory what it's worth and the best stuff sells out. And so that is just, it's created because of the relationship between supply and demand. It's just created a little bit of an easier ecosystem to make sure that you're not getting clubbed when you're buying in-house.
Yeah, I like that Amanda mentioned micro-influencer because that was going to be our next thing, right? The big push with influencer marketing was like, okay, let's go after the big ones. Let's go after the names that everybody knows, get the most awareness. And then eventually as kind of like the attributable performance was going down with those big names, everyone's going toward like the micro-influencers, you know, people with a few thousand Instagram followers. I forget what the limit is on like the minimum of what someone has to have as for Instagram followers to be a micro influencer. But like, is there a strategy and is there any way to do it in like a like organized and not chaotic fashion to go after massive amounts of micro podcast, you know, owners? Or is it just so difficult to scale because you do have to have a little bit more of that handholding aspect of like onboarding, you know, getting them to understand the message properly and all of that. Like if I, instead of wanting to go after like someone with like, I don't even know what the average views of like someone who's a really popular podcast is. You know, let's say a million listens a week. If I wanted to go after, you know, 10,000 like micro podcasters with a few hundred like listens per week, is there any way to really do that? Or it just doesn't work for a channel like this where it might work for something like Instagram?
Well, I think you have to cover the brand safety aspect of this. This is still user-generated content. There is no FCC oversight. There are no official standards and practices. Yeah. I can say anything I want into my phone, post it, and insert one of your ads. You're not going to have a review window to know what you are supporting with your name next to whatever they just said, which can lead to very, very crazy edge case scenarios. And you also have to ask yourself, like, all right, the best ones are somewhat manual. I mean, the craftsmanship of onboarding, having somebody get on the phone and explain, having them use the product, is it worth your time for your company to do all of that for something that's going to be a $200 unit once a month? What is your time worth? And so you have to manage, you have to hold those in one hand. You can buy all you want. There's efficient ways to do it, but you're absorbing a tremendous amount of risk. And at some point, everybody's got a cliff for what their time and energy is worth. And you have to know how to do that equation based on where you're at and where your business is at.
Performance kind of drives everything at the end of the day. Like Dan said, if you're going to do a $200 spot, like it's not going to drive. It's not going to move the needle. There's plenty of larger opportunities out there. And it kind of depends on your budget too. So if there's only so many hours in a day, there's systems that you can use to scale. But as we were all saying, seeding a product and actually having somebody receive that and have that relationship, if there's no onboarding call and there's no communication, well, it's going to fail. So there's really no point in trying to go after something that small, especially if you're newer to the space. If you're in it and you're spending millions of dollars a month, then you're looking for the next new opportunity. And it kind of depends on what makes sense, but also depends on the product too. If you're trying to deliver mattresses to a small micro influencer, you have to really think about that decision versus sending them a Harry's razor. There's different considerations for each type of a product and brand, but performance kind of wins out at the end of the day on what makes sense.
Makes sense, especially for a scaling brand. They want something repeatable and somewhat attributable and scalable. So it makes sense. But like, I'm wondering whether like a really small company who's just like, fuck it, I'm going to find some really unique way to reach out to like 2,000 really small podcasters could see something. It might be painful, but
I literally, the idea of it makes me want to pull my hair out. Cause here's the thing.
You could
do a lot of things.
It's a lot of your time, right? I think I was managing directly myself until I got to the point where I was like, this is all I'm doing. All I'm doing is like listening to air checks and sending out snacks and onboarding people and setting up vanity URLs. Like it was literally all I was doing, right? And I had five other channels that I had to manage. So that's when you bring on people and consultants and agencies.
Is the squeeze worth the juice? That's the question. Are you going to really find meaningful scale for your business taking that approach? Or is it like, okay, we're going to start with a test budget of 75K. We're going to look at shows at different sizes. We're going to buy some shows that are like $1,000 an episode or $600 an episode. We'll buy a couple of shows that are like $4,000 an episode. We're going to buy like a good solid mix of sizes, genres, styles, all of that stuff. And then use that to directionally point forward. If you find that you need to go, it's kind of like long tail, right? Think it's the 80-20 rule will wind up most likely being true in some way here as well. It's like, how long tail do you want to go on your search keywords? Well, that depends. And it's a little different in an aggregated platform like that to take a long tail approach versus what we're talking about, where it's like, if for all of those micros, you're talking about a unique individual every time versus even publishers and networks where you can buy tens of shows. So a lot of that is like, you are probably creating more work. Even if you're spending less money on the media, the opportunity cost you're losing might actually wind up putting you in the red on the channel. So you got to be careful about that.
Yeah, if your growth marketer's time.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And this is why we have panels full of experts to tell me when an idea is just really not smart.
I mean, listen, if there's like somebody really loves like, and Bachelor shows, I don't know, I'm on a Bachelor kick today. If Bachelor shows really crush for somebody and somebody wants to go out and find the 20 shows in that genre and just blanket it, and it's also like part of a partnership, like there's always edge cases for these things. And that's where I think it's just like, do the smart edge cases. And it's also about what's in the proportion of your other marketing efforts. You know what I mean? Like just thinking about everybody being an actual human being who, like Molly said,
has to work across 4 or 5 different channels, and you know, it can be a lot to manage.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And this is one thing that's kind of been shown throughout this entire conversation is this is a much more engaged channel. You know, you can't just push pull levers like kind of like Facebook or Google and not have human relationships with people. So it makes a lot of sense. How many human relationships can you handle, and what's the worth of that, and what's the return that you're going to get on that? And, you know, it sounds like a lot of pain if you're kind of going after every local small, you know, podcast in your town, but who knows, it might actually be some crazy strategy that works for someone. So I'm holding like this much of a thread that like someone does that and like blankets every podcast like host with like 10 listeners a week.
Thanks for tuning in to Culture, Talent, and Growth. If you found value in this conversation, please leave a review, subscribe, and share this episode with a friend. You can visit bringruckus.com for more ways to connect. And remember, new episodes come out on Tuesday.